This is my last broadcast as the anchorman of the CBS Evening News. For me, it's a moment for which I long have planned, but which nevertheless comes with some sadness. For almost two decades, after all, we've been meeting like this in the evenings, and I'll miss that. But those who have made anything of this departure, I'm afraid, have made too much. This is but a transition, a passing of the baton. A great broadcaster and gentleman, Doug Edwards, preceded me in this job, and another, Dan Rather, will follow. And anyway, the person who sits here is but the most conspicuous member of a superb team of journalists, writers, reporters, editors, producers, and none of that will change. Furthermore, I'm not even going away. I'll be back from time to time with special news reports and documentaries, and beginning in June, every week with our science program, Universe. Old anchormen, you see, don't fade away. They just keep coming back for more. And that's the way it is. Friday, March 6th, 1981. I'll be away on assignment, and Dan Rather will be sitting in here for the next few years. Good night.
At the time Walter Cronkite signed off as CBS news anchor in 1981, he was called the most trusted man in America. But journalists today are regarded with increasing suspicion. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Year. My guest, Professor Sue Robinson, is the Helen First Brook Franklin Professor of Journalism in the School of Journalism and Mass Communications at the UW-Madison. She went from being a mainstream journalist to a teacher of would-be journalists and a scholar looking at new models of approaching the field. Her groundbreaking 2023 Oxford University Press book is entitled How Journalists Engage, A Theory of Trust Building, Identities, and Care. She joins me for a program today we're calling Should Journalists Be Trusted? I noticed in the early parts of your book, you make your own journey to journalism part of the story. And I wonder if you could kind of trace that for us. You know, what made you drawn to the field of journalism to begin with?
When I was in the eighth grade, I used to have this little recorder device, and I would go around to all of my eighth grade classmates asking them questions and peppering them with all kinds of, you know, queries about who they were and what they wanted to do. And then I just knew that I wanted to be a journalist. But I was a very mainstream journalist. I went to my undergrad, declared as a major in journalism. I got my master's in it. I did my PhD in it, all in very mainstream journalism. And I spent about 13 years in the industry, just really interested in telling people's stories. That's really what I wanted. I loved to write. I liked people. It seemed a natural fit.
And did you see it as a sort of noble calling?
Of course, because we did not get paid anything. And we felt it too, right? Like we put our heart and soul into it. You were there all the time. You were on call 24/7. I mean, especially you look at journalists today and the news cycle is just so intense. And yet, if you ask them what their salaries are, they're pretty low.
Did you feel your job was pursuing the truth and that you had to sort of stay independent from the other, you know, sometimes journalism is called that fourth estate or almost like a fourth branch, but you had to stay independent of the three branches of government?
Everybody who considers himself a mainstream traditional journalist bought into that hook, line, and sinker. And I think for good reason, right? Because we believe that in order to have a vibrant democracy, we need to have a thriving, independent press that serves not only as our nation's storytellers, what happened during the day, but also contextualizing what happened, historicizing it, and also watchdogging, right? Being the people who are out there, like making sure the town council was doing what it was supposed to do, what it was elected to do. And that's how we teach our students as well at the School of Journalism and Mass Communication.
And what about the field of investigative reporting? Sort of, you know, the one that the Aaron Brockovich types, the ones who go after the big companies, or you know, they may get told no, but they keep pursuing until they find out, yes, there's lead in the water.
I mean, we need that now more than ever, and we've always needed it. Unfortunately, it's expensive, right? Because those people need sometimes weeks, sometimes months to do those kinds of investigations. And as staffs have been reduced over the last decade or two, almost three decades now, we have fewer and fewer people who can do that and still fill all of the holes that need to be filled in terms of just what's happening during the day. So we need investigative journalism. We're still training journalists. And we just, we need to make sure that we have room in the profession to continue funding that kind of work.
I opened the hour with a clip from Walter Cronkite signing off in 1981. At that point, and throughout the time that he was the anchor of CBS, people would gather to watch the news and viewed him as sort of one of the most trusted people in America. Can you talk about why that was, whether that was actually an illusion that should never have been?
Well, Walter Cronkite was a different era, and also he was television. So we all had these feelings that we knew our TV anchors, right? Because we saw them every night. It was almost like they were talking right to us. So we had this familiarity with them that bred in this intense trust. And I think that's still around, particularly for TV broadcasters and now podcasters and TV news people. And so I think, though, we know now that journalism that was happening for all of those decades was so necessary, but it also did exclude and stereotype entire groups of people. We know that now, right? And that not everybody saw themselves represented in the news or even felt like Walter Cronkite was speaking to them personally. And so I think now with the research and the scholarship that we know we can build different kinds of relationships. We know that we can produce different kinds of content that actually is much more relevant to greater swaths of people and demographics.
What is some of the work you did then that you're the proudest of? And when did you start feeling that it wasn't enough, that you needed to become a professor of journalism rather than a practicing reporter?
I was mostly a business reporter. I covered the state economy. I covered agriculture. I covered nuclear power. I covered taxes. I covered mortgage rates. But I did have to go on radio and public TV here and there because I was a state economy reporter. I always did poorly, to be honest. So I'm proud of all of it. I was a daily reporter. I was also an investigative reporter. I loved all of it. I loved telling the stories. I loved finding out stuff. I loved the research, all of it. And I think it was needed. You know, I always thought I had all these big stories that I did. For example, I did a bunch of stuff around agriculture in Vermont and how agriculture was dying in the similar way that's happening here over the last few decades in Wisconsin. But when you would go to your friend's house and you see your column about taking a vacation up on the refrigerator, you realize like all of the content mattered, that is, some of it was connecting with someone somewhere. So that was really good. And then we started getting layoffs. So this was the late 90s. And it started becoming such a secure job. I was at that point in my late 20s, and I wanted to settle down, and I didn't want to be on call 24/7, and I needed a bigger paycheck. And all of these things started to make me feel like maybe I wanted to go back to school and get my PhD, which had always been the plan. And then I was sitting in the office of the new economic director for the state, and we were supposed to do a profile on him and talk about what his plan was, right? And so this was Vermont, and at that time, IBM was the biggest employer, and they were laying off left and right, and agriculture was the second biggest employer, and they, of course, were contracting. And so I kept asking him, you know, how do we as a state make sure we have some backup plans for our economy? Like, what are you putting into place? What are you thinking about? Let's brainstorm here. And he kept saying this, what we call message track in the newsroom, which is, our state workers are resilient. We will figure this out. And it was just, he just said the same thing over and over again. And I was getting so frustrated. And that was the moment I decided it was time to apply to PhD schools.
When you're talking about layoffs, is this partly the economics of newspapers that are declining in part? Or, you know, because we have fewer print newspapers than we used to. And
Yes, all of that. The industry itself has been contracting for a couple decades now, not just newspapers, although that's a big one, but across the board, in part for a number of different reasons, in part because we didn't pivot as well as we should have when digital technologies came on. So that's part of it. But also we just lost our three strands of revenue, which were classifieds. You know, those went to Craigslist and now Facebook and Marketplace and all of those. We lost advertising because that went online as well. We've been able to pick some of that back up. And then finally, of course, subscriptions. And so we're starting to see a lot new business models for different kinds of journalism, which I think is great, and including here in Madison. We have a very vibrant media sphere here, which is kind of unusual. But in general, news, there are huge news deserts across the United States where people are not getting any local or regional or even state news. It's really dire out there. And I just make a plea that everybody support your local journalists because we need them.
I know we're going to talk more about local journalism and ways to change that model shortly. But let's look a little bit more with the economics of it. The pressure on journalists to write the story that sells papers or gets ratings if it's TV, where, you know, maybe there's a little bit of snow, but the headline is, you know, giant snowstorm coming. You know, looking for some story on a celebrity to sell papers or to get the, you know, the income out there. Can you talk a little bit about the pressure on journalists to get the story that will sell the most papers or get the highest ratings and how that factors into journalistic integrity?
Yeah, I know that that's the impression that a lot of people have. But as somebody who works with newsrooms, reads a lot of journalism, I actually don't see the sort of mainstream traditional journalists or even the alternative and nonprofit world that have good intentions engaging that much in clickbait and sort of the sensational news that you're talking about. Rather, I see, you know, nobody's covering the school board anymore. You know, I see more of these sort of blocks because a lot of these newsrooms have contracted by as much as 65% over the last 10 years. And if you think about that, that means you have one journalist now covering 5, 6, 7 beats, different specialties, and they have to be an expert in all of those different things. That's a really, really hard job for them to do. Also, a lot of these newsrooms have cut down on their multimedia staff. So journalists are also supposed to be adept at taking photos and doing multimedia. And hey, why don't you do this podcast? And when you spread anybody that thin in a particular workplace, you're going to end up getting thinner coverage. And the coverage isn't going to be as substantive. And so I see that being more of the problem. In terms of the competitive marketplace, I think it's super interesting to look at what's happening locally because we have all of these amazing news outlets. We have Madison Magazine and Channel 3000 and Isthmus and Wisconsin State Journal and the Cap Times and Madison 365 and I mean, Tone. We just have so many. Forgive me if I've missed a whole bunch. I think I have. The UKOW, like all of these different organizations. And what I'd love to see is more collaboration. Now, some of these are public subsidized. Some of them are nonprofits now. Isthmus turned to become a nonprofit in 2020. Madison 365 started as a nonprofit in 2015. Some of these are operating as a nonprofit, like Cap Times, for example. That's a joint ownership with Lee Enterprises and Evu Foundation. I'd love to see us sort of collaborating more on who's going to be covering what rather than sort of everybody covering the renaming of the elementary school, you know, which happened this week. I saw like 3 or 4 different stories about that. Why not instead we work together? This is kind of a radical idea. I'm just now floating it, so I don't know how many of my friends in these newsrooms would even think about this. But I feel like that would be really helpful if we all kind of knew what everybody was covering so that we can put our full efforts behind things that have to get covered, right? What's happening in state government, what's happening in city on the city council, what's happening culturally, what's happening business-wise and economically, all of that.
So you're kind of imagining a collaborative model, looking at the total and the number of stories that need to be told, and then figuring out how to divide the work. I want to ask you about the concept of journalistic objectivity, because you talk about that in your book, that the usual way journalists had been trained is to pretty much take yourself and your opinions out of the story. That if you are interviewing someone, they shouldn't know what you feel or think. That your job is to interview people, to get the facts, and to get the story out, and keep yourself out of it. But you say that's somewhat not only impossible, but maybe not the right approach. First of all, tell us about journalistic objectivity, why that concept exists, what role that does play.
Sure. So objectivity has been around for more than a century, at least in terms of a value for our U.S. Western-based mainstream traditional news. And there were a number of different reasons about it. Some of them were more historical, but mostly it was about commercial, right? We had a colonial press that was partisan when we first started this country in the 1600s. And then gradually over time, we had more and more people who could read. We had more and more people who could now suddenly afford the so-called penny press. And so they wanted, news publishers wanted to reach broader audiences. And so they needed to come back from the partisan angle and instead create a so-called objective content that everybody would be interested in reading. So ultimately, it was a commercial reason for why they did that. And then, of course, it became aligned with democracy, right? We needed a watchdog. We needed that fourth estate, which basically means where the fourth checks and balances, you know, in addition to the administration, the legislative, and the courts. And so that's the idea behind objectivity. And it has been kind of a mantra for all newsrooms that they consider themselves mainstream for decades, for generations, honestly. And at the same time has been problematic right from the beginning, because we know that objectivity is an impossible standard. It has always been kind of more an ideal. And something we talked about in the newsroom is like, well, we need to try to be balanced. We need to try to be as fair to people as possible. And we've also know that the way that it has become practiced has resulted in more binary reporting, like he said, she said, they said, or false equivalency. There is a right to climate change and a wrong to climate change. So we ended up with coverage that I have argued in some of my scholarship is unethical when we think about objectivity as it is practiced. It doesn't mean that it's still not a good ideal. Like, we still need to be interviewing people and trying to mitigate our own opinions and values in order for the story to really shine. That still can be possible. But we also have to appreciate that we all hold identities, we all hold value systems, and we all hold stances. And so what I try to teach my students now, and then the work that we do with newsrooms, is how can we consider where we stand on this as we approach this interview, where I'm going to hear things that maybe I don't agree with. How am I going to mitigate that, and how am I going to be supremely transparent about that going forward?
You mentioned that something could be unethical if you have a binary approach, and if you feel there's the right side and then you have this other side too, and you give them equal weight. Are you talking about a situation where you're trying to be balanced, but you're giving equal time to something that is unambiguously evil, let's just say, or filled with hate, or, you know, are you talking about not going so far in the pursuit of balance that you make it seem like everything's equal?
Right. And that's so important right now. So I wrote a different book. It's called News After Trump, Journalism's Crisis of Relevancy in a Changed Media Culture. And in there, we look at this idea of false equivalency. So, and we were looking specifically at U.S. President Trump 2016 to 2020 presidency. And we were looking at the lying that was happening and also the racism that was happening from our elected officers, our politicians, and what journalists were doing when they came across a lie or came across a racist statement. And we made the argument in that book that we that all journalists need to be guided by our moral voice. That is, if something is blatantly racist and we understand it to be racist because of some contextualization that you can do given the evidence, right, that you have in front of you, then journalists have an obligation to call that out as racism, right? That you can still cover politicians with balance and with fairness, and also this was a lie because we have these three pieces of evidence. So that's sort of what this is sort of the approach that we're talking about.
More on journalism, objectivity, moral relativism, and what to do about it all when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Sue Robinson, and we are talking about the question, should journalists be trusted? And you were just mentioning that journalists will run into a problem of racism when they're covering stories, and that it affected your approach in an earlier book that you wrote. Can you talk about your own journey in terms of understanding racism and how that played a role in your field of journalism?
Oh, sure. I mean, that was a very, very long journey. So I started this book called Network News, Racial Divides, How Power and Privilege Shape Public Discourse in Progressive Communities. And it's a case studies of Madison and four other progressive cities in the U.S. But Madison is a major case study. And by the way, I name names in there. So if you are somebody who knows Madison politics, you'll love this book. It was published in 2018 with Cambridge University Press. I started this book in 2010. And at the time, all I wanted to do was figure out how digital technologies were reconstituting local community news flows. That's all I wanted. But I chose this topic of the Urban League of Greater Madison and Kaleem Care's proposal to do Madison Prep, which was this charter school. It ended up failing, so you might not know about this. This was like 2010, and it was going to be paid for by the school district. And it was only going to educate Black boys and girls. And I thought, oh, this is going to be super controversial. Like, I'm going to have so much media to analyze and to work with, and people are going to be talking about this in online spaces and offline spaces. So that's what I wanted to do. And then, of course, it was about race, and particularly it was about how Black and brown boys and girls were being educated or not educated in our K-12 school system. And when I tried to get people to show up at these focus groups to talk about how they got information about this, their schools and all of that, nobody showed up. And I would just sit there and I would be like, I don't know why these people aren't coming. And so I went to talk to Alex G, Reverend Alex G and Dr. Alex G, who, of course, is breaking ground on the new Center for Black Excellence. And I asked him, we had like this really great hour-long talk, and I said, hey, can I put a request on your Facebook page to have Black and brown parents come and talk to me? And he said, no, no, you can't. And I said, why not? I said, we just spent an hour talking about how you wanted more Black and brown voices to be heard in media, and here I am offering that opportunity, and now you're saying no. And he says, well, I don't know who you are. You present as this white academic, you know, from the university, representing journalists who have not been a friend to the Black and brown communities. Why would I say yes to this? And that was a real shocker to me, you know, as a former journalist and as somebody who's really just bought full into, and I think I still do, that everybody loves journalists, right? That everybody should love journalists if we want a vibrant democracy. And so I ended up having to do a lot of work on myself. I started my own racial journey, understanding my own whiteness, understanding the history of my own family in this country, understanding like how complicit I had been as a white journalist, as the business reporter, and you know, either enacting stereotypes or just marginalizing people or just completely ignoring different kinds of stories, or in the way I was teaching, right, in the different slides and stuff that I was using, the different examples I would give about who's an authority and who isn't, that kind of thing. And it took me 2 years. And that's why this book ended up taking 8 years before it was published, because I had to do that work force. And then I also had to start giving back to my communities. I started volunteering. I just had to I had to do the work, right? You know what I'm talking about, Emily. You've done the work. You know what the work is. And so I had to do that. And that was a really intense and illustrative journey for me that I'm still on, right? And so I was able to write that book from a much deeper understanding, because then I could go to all these journalists and ask them, like, why did you cover this story in this way? What do you think we left out when we wrote about it in this way? How would you have done that differently? And I started realizing that all the reporters that I was talking to in these progressive cities identified as white. And maybe because I was also white and also a formal journalist, they would talk to me pretty frankly about how they felt like race was a real minefield for them. And, you know, some people talked about it as sticky. Some people talked about it as, like, that's one of the reasons why I would stick to talking to politicians and administrators, because I knew if I stayed at that level, I wasn't going to get myself into trouble by saying the wrong thing or asking the wrong question. And so once that book was done, I realized there was a whole other field that I needed to think about, a whole other problem, which is, how can white reporters talk about race in a way that's more meaningful and contributes to advancing our conversations around inequities in a better way? And that's when this new 2023 book was born.
And how does that fit with the experience you had watching the coverage of the Prep Academy?
So that book documents how the way in which Progressive Dane, the Madison Teachers Union, you know, the various blogs that was happening at that point, this was like before Medium and before Substack. It was before all of that. It was like blogs. We did these blogs. Do you remember that? And Facebook groups and all of that. And so we had these people who were very, very vocal in progressive circles. And what I found was that conversation was online with these progressive entities was 36% larger than anything that was happening in print or in online spaces for mainstream media. And so for me, it was very indicative of how whoever's in power within a particular community, and here we're talking about progressive communities, they were able to sort of control that conversation and control how information flowed around it. And so with Madison Prep, what you ended up seeing were people like Kaleem Kerr and others who were trying to advocate for this charter school were getting drowned out by these other narratives that were happening. So in progressive cities, the narratives around charter schools are that they are bad, right? They are evil. We do not talk about vouchers. That's just a tool for the right to privatize and defund public education. And I'm not saying that doesn't happen, but that's what ended up obscuring an actual conversation about why we needed a charter school for Black boys and girls, what was happening in our K-12 systems that made, you know, these disparities so stark, right?
So I wonder if we can hear a clip just from news coverage at the time.
But first, tonight at 6, supporters of a charter school in Madison hope decision makers will put learning before labor. And those supporters say teacher union contracts are getting in the way of helping low-income minority students succeed.
As supporters rally before a critical school board vote, Andy Choi shows us why the school district says opening Madison Prep is a complex process.
So if I have 4 boys, that means 2 of them are not going to make it. One of them are going to be in jail.
Tears in Jalatifa Joe Meyer's eyes show the urgency of finding a solution to Madison's achievement gap.
Our kids are not being educated. They're not going to college. 1% of them are college ready. 47% of Black males aged 25 to 29 are incarcerated.
Kaleem Kerr hopes the Madison Preparatory Academy can help change those stats. If approved, the city-funded charter school would accept low-income minority students starting next fall.
Regardless of what happens with Madison Prep, whether it's approved or it's not approved, this conversation about kids and unequal levels of achievement needs to continue.
School District Superintendent Dan Neerad says the proposal's use of non-union staff would infringe upon the district's current teacher union contract. Kerr says it's time learning comes before labor.
The decisions that have been made in Madison Metropolitan School District for a mighty long time have been determined by adults getting what they need first before kids. And it's not just endemic to us here. It's endemic everywhere.
NARAD says under the current proposal, Madison Prep's day-to-day activities would need more district oversight.
This is a $17 million investment over a five-year period of time. And as a result of that, it was my feeling there should be more direct day-to-day oversight of the program.
Supporters say they've jumped through enough administrative hoops, and they're hoping others in the community support their cause.
On December 19th, go to the Board of Education, be there with us, and tell them to support this school. If not Madison Prep, then what?
And December 19th is when the Madison School Board is set to vote on the charter school. We reached out to the members of the Madison School Board, several tonight unavailable or unwilling to make public statements on the issues before that vote on the 19th.
The story will continue to cover right up to that date and beyond. Andy Choi, thanks a lot, Andy.
You're welcome.
So what is it you hear in this news clip from over a decade ago?
Yeah, so this is so classic. I mean, it's a great clip on its case. Like, if I were a journalist, I would be really proud of this clip. But what we see here is we have these two binaries, right? We have the people who are for this proposal, and we have people who are against the proposal. And rather, I think it would have been more helpful had we tried to understand what was happening in the K through 12 schools that we were having such intense disparities. And the disparities were everything from test results to graduation rates to suspension rates. I mean, it was stark. I was looking at one statistic where they were showing that one in every one white kid to every 15 black boys were being suspended. It was crazy ratios. And so that's what this sets up, right? It sets up like, okay, the problem with this proposal is this. That's what Dan Narad is saying. He's the superintendent at that time. And Kaleem and all of these people who came out to these rallies, to these dozens of public hearings, telling the stories of what was happening with their kids, they felt like they were not being heard by the school board, because all the school board was thinking is, do we need this charter school or do we not? And what are the politics of that? And so rather, in my book, I sort of document how that conversation could have gone a different way, right? We, instead of making the proposal about a far right, because at some point the progressives who were in charge were talking about Kaleem being backed by all these far right funders. I don't know if you remember this, but this was back in the day. And so we had this, it ended up becoming like, okay, charter school bad. We're a progressive place. We have these proud civil rights histories. We can't do this. Our schools, are fine the way they are. Rather than saying, you know what, actually, they're not fine for whole groups of people. And we need to look at the structures and the systems that are in place for that. And what happened with the mainstream journalists is that they reified that sort of progressive narrative that was happening.
So you're saying journalists, instead of just reporting a story that seemed to have two polar opposite approaches and it was either going to succeed or fail, in this case it failed, should have been looking for something more nuanced, something, a third truth or a different approach to the same problem? That's putting a lot of weight on journalists then to go beyond. And I guess that is sort of the topic of your newest book, How Journalists Engage, A Theory of Trust Building Identities and Care, because it seems in different chapters of the book that you're almost advocating for journalists to play a role in bringing about change, that it's not enough to report on a problem. You need to be part of the solution pursuit. And I will say, sometimes when watching, let's say it's a television broadcast and you have a journalist reporting on some terrible disaster, and sometimes almost smiling and looking like they're thinking of their makeup and hair while telling you about this disaster that's happening behind them, you have the impulse as a viewer to say, turn around and help that child behind you. Get off the soapbox or the reporting box and pitch in. Do you ever have that where you're watching the news and you're wanting the journalists to pitch in, which of course is not their job?
There is a lot in that, Lee, if I can just unpack it for a little bit. I know all of the journalists I know, and I know thousands of journalists at this point between the students that have come through, my friends who are still in the industry, the great journalists that I work with in all of these consultations and applied research that we do, that I don't know a single journalist who feels happy about trauma or tragedy. And I also know that covering all of that day after day after day is very traumatic on them as people. And so that's another arena that is growing, which is self-care for journalists and making sure newsrooms have in place mental health and well-being and things like that. And so I can guarantee you that if you're feeling that, the journalist is also feeling that because they are people. And I think there is this sort of narrative that journalists don't care. And that's as far from the truth as anything I have ever seen, including everywhere here in Madison, like all of the journalists that I know here. And at the same time, I think a lot of my friends here in Madison who are journalists would disagree with me that, yes, I think we should be taking a more proactive role in helping communities advance conversations and be part of the solution. Because I think that journalists are in a very unique space, in a very unique position to know everybody in the field. Let's say we're talking about housing insecurity because that's what I'm working on right now. They know who's doing what where, whereas these people who are working on these solutions and this nonprofit and that nonprofit and this program over there, they don't necessarily know the full network of programs that are out there, of resources that are out there. And journalists are in this unique place to say, hey, you're having this problem over here. Well, this group over here has figured out how to solve that. Let's connect you two together. And I think that's a role that journalists can play that we haven't traditionally played.
Sounds like a journalistic activist.
Yeah. Well, I don't like the word activist because I do think that does connote everything that people don't like about journalists, right? Because people who dislike journalists or don't trust journalists, they're like, well, they're just activists for this leftist agenda or they're activists for this particular politician. Rather, I think about it more as caregivers, like as community caregivers. I'm trying to get that to catch on. Maybe this radio show will help us to catch that
on. So not journalistic activist, but journalistic caregiver.
Yeah.
We'll talk more about that in a moment when we continue with University of the Air. Journalists have identities, of course. They are just taught to hide them. No posting of political signs, no attending protests as a participant, no letting anyone know your political leanings. Some even went so far as to disenfranchise themselves, so committed they were to maintain objective appearances. That's from the chapter in the book, How Journalists Engage a Theory of Trust-Building Identities and Care. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with my guest, Sue Robinson. We are talking about her research and work in the field on changing how journalists are trained and how they operate. So rather than hiding your leanings and your biases, you're sort of suggesting in different parts of this book, make that part of the transparency between you and whatever audience you're working on and go from there. Tell me how you envision, like, let's say you have a brand new class of journalism students. What are the key lessons that you now give them?
Well, we start off with identity training and implicit bias, and so that they can understand for themselves what their identities are, what their values are, and how those values might be impacting who they choose as sources, what stories they decide to do, how they go about reporting those sources, how they choose quotes to be fit into that story, how they figure out the frame of the story. So what I try to do with these new journalists is say, hey, you know, you do have a perspective and you are coming from somewhere, and that's going to influence all of these decisions that you do in your work. So we start off there.
And do you have pushback where someone says, well, just because I'm a man, that doesn't mean I can't understand women. Just because I'm white doesn't mean I can't be sensitive to other races. What do you mean I have these biases?
Yeah, that's a really good point. No, because I'm not suggesting that just because you're white, you can't cover stories about black or brown people. And I'm not suggesting that your identity means you can only cover the things that you identify with. I'm only suggesting that You have to be aware of where your biases lie as you approach your job so you can mitigate them. And whether that means transparency with your sources, or whether there's some kind of policy that's happening at the editorial level where you talk about, hey, I'm going to be reporting on the schools. I have two kids in the schools. So that's going to affect, you know, what I report on and how I report on it. But I'm going to take these steps in figuring out how I'm going to make sure that this story is balanced.
Okay, so I've got that lesson in. And I know that there's a lot of work on that in terms of hiring biases, just looking at even now where if you submit the same CV but you put a name that's female, people may think it's a, you know, less, I don't know, authoritative kind of thing. Or if it has an African-American sounding name, there may be certain biases that are happening just looking at the same essay with a different name put on it. So I know there's a lot of work in recognizing bias all across the board. But let's say you've got your new journalism students in training and you start by having them recognize their own biases, and then what?
Then I make them do things they're not comfortable with. I make them go talk to a whole bunch of people who don't look like them or think like them. And just get them used to talking to about all kinds of things with people who are expressing views they never thought that they would ever agree with. And I think that's part of it, right? We have to expose our students to as many different worldviews as possible so that they can be have as expansive a worldview in order to do the important work of reporting on democracy.
And how do you teach them to ask the kind of questions that wouldn't be necessarily the gotcha questions, but the kind of questions that do bring out useful information and maybe get more material than someone who's not trained as a journalist would get?
Yeah, that is such a great question. So I spend a lot of time moving them away from what we call transactional or extractive interviewing skills, where it's the gotcha kind of style that you see, you know, in a press conference, for example. And instead, I teach alternative ways of getting information by talking and listening to people. So for example, in that very beginning journalism class that we're talking about, I'll invite a community leader or elected official in, and we're going to conduct a listening session, right? And so I have food, and we sit around in a circle. The last time I taught this class, I invited Ali Muldrow, who is on the Board of Education in Madison at this time. She came in, and she just had a chance to ask them questions. So I also talked to them about how you can build trust in these very tiny snippets of time that you have to build trust with a source because you're still on deadline and you still have to create the content. How do you do that, right? And so we teach these alternative ways of interviewing. And another way that we do this is called looping. I don't know if you've ever heard. It's a listening technique that comes from organizational development. And there's a book that came out a couple of years back. It was by Amanda Ripley, and it's called High Conflict. It's a wonderful book. It's really saved a lot of my relationships by rethinking how we have conversations that might be controversial or that you might have conflict with someone. And you use these looping techniques that she talks about. So I teach my students that kind of interviewing as well.
Can you give me an example of how that would work?
Yeah, so there's a lot of examples with her, you know, that she's actually mitigating conversations between two people who have polarizing differences around politics, for example. And so you invite somebody to have your conversation. You ask them their view on something, whatever the story's about. They'll give their view, and then you synthesize what they said in your own words and you repeat it back to them, asking them for clarification to make sure that you truly are understanding all the nuances of what the person is saying. And then the person has that opportunity to expand or nuance what they just said. And so what you end up with is a much more substantive soundbite than you would had you just peppered them with questions.
But let's say the person that is speaking is saying something that you actually personally think is ludicrous or misguided or something. Look, let's say you're interviewing me and I say, I don't think people should be allowed to be left-handed anymore. You know, let's only have right-handed folks. then you just repeat that back to me and say, I hear you saying. How does that help cut through anything?
Well, so I think the idea is, let's take the left-handed example, right? You have to get at the heart of why you make that belief, right? Because what you're looking for are common values that we all share as human beings. And that's really what we're trying to get at in looping or different kind of listening techniques. Now, that is to say, we did this intervention, I'll call it, a couple years ago, where we asked 9 journalists to go and interview or have listening sessions with people who are disengaged from their brand and yet represented an audience segment they wanted to expand in some way.
What do you mean by disengaged from their brand?
They hated them. The audience member was not an audience member, but they hated the news brand. And this was an exercise in, like, how do we increase our audiences and get people to trust us, people who do not trust us? And so we said, all right, go find, you know, and some of them were right-leaning people, and then some of them were BIPOC people, depending on what the journalist was trying to, what audiences that the journalist was trying to expand into. And we said, you're not allowed to respond. You're not allowed to get defensive. You just have to ask them, what do you think about the journalism that we do, and what would you see differently? And then they would talk, the community member would talk for about 30 to 45 minutes. And there were 78 conversations for these 9 people. And it was about half right-leaning people and half BIPOC people. And what I did was we recorded the conversations. Then we asked both the reporter and the community member to complete a survey about how the conversation went. And then we did a focus group with the reporters, the 9 reporters. And we had so much vitriol, like screaming at these journalists, right? And a lot of it were people who were saying all kinds of racist and homophobic things about how the journalists, you know, had these leftist agendas and all they cared about was, you know, trans men being allowed to use the women's bathroom, like all kinds of different pretty hate-filled conversations. And the journalists just listened. And then when we looked at the post surveys from the community members, 85% of them said that 30 minutes built trust for them in that brand and the person that they were talking to, even though the journalists didn't say anything at all. And a third of them said they would subscribe.
So wait a minute. The people listening, not the ones who were spewing the hate.
No, the people spewing the hate.
The people spewing the hate said they trusted the journalists more. And is that just because they saw they were being listened to?
Yep. It goes to the power of listening. Now, when we had the focus group with the 9 journalists, we ended up having kind of a therapy session because it was really difficult for them to sort of listen to be yelled at, I guess, over and over and over again by these people. And they were saying, you know, some of these people want us to stop covering race. They want us to stop covering LGBTQ. They want us to stop, calling out lies. And we're not willing to do that. And so that's really the quagmire there, is like, how do we break through those kinds of barriers? Because clearly we can't go backwards, right? Clearly we can't stop covering all of these really important topics.
In the few minutes that we have left, can you talk about some of the projects that you're interested in pursuing going forward that would help, I guess, elevate the role of local journalism or put journalism students in new situations than their traditional training?
I would love to. I'm working with the Odyssey, the UW Odyssey project, which I think you're familiar with, as well as Community Shares, and then a host of different nonprofits in town, including Own It, Building Black Wealth, and Madison Tenant Power, as well as the city of Madison. And we're working with all of these groups through Madison Commons, which is the news site that's about 20 years old that works out of the School of Journalism and Mass Communication. It's a hyper-local site that trains our students in how to do community-based reporting. And what we're trying to do is figure out, like, okay, we chose housing insecurity as the topic for the next couple years. What role can we play as journalists to document the struggles that are happening, the lived experiences, in a solutions-focused way? Like, what role can we play? So it's kind of an experiment to see, you know, so I have some people embedded in these organizations. We're working very closely with Odyssey on the idea of family scholar housing, which would help families that are non-traditional students who are enrolled in degree programs have housing. So that's one thing that they don't have to worry about as they're working their three jobs and trying to get a degree and better their lives. And so we're trying to figure out, like, can we do events? Can we connect different policymakers and stakeholders around these different unbelievable solutions that all these people are doing in these spaces? And so that's like one of the experiments that we're working with.
And so with your use of the term caregiver before, would it be that you want your students to care about homelessness, that you start with the problem you're looking at, that people are sleeping on the street or not able to find affordable housing, you know, that we look at homelessness and care about it, and then use your journalistic role to try to point to some kind of solution that others may not see?
Yeah, exactly. So we can look at other kinds of communities and what has worked in other places. You know, so for example, a couple of my students are going to be traveling with Brian Benford, who works as a social worker at Odyssey, to Kentucky and to Minnesota, where these family scholar housing programs are already thriving. So what are they doing that we might be able to replicate here? But yes, getting back to the idea that we understand as all humans, we all need shelter. Right? We all need to feel warm. We all need to feel safe in our day-to-day and our evening lives, right? And so caring about people who are unhoused at any particular moment is such a fundamental value that I don't think is about activism, right? It's about caring for our fellow humans and how can we all work to the betterment of all of us.
So it's a really different model of journalism then, because it's not just investigative journalism, although that's part of it, because you're investigating what is out there, what might work, what's a solution, but you're also working in tandem with different community organizations as well. Have you had pushback about your approach where somebody within the School of Journalism says, hey, Sue, that doesn't sound like journalism. That sounds maybe more like, I don't know, social work?
Yeah, you know, A little bit. So Madison Commons, you know, we have a professional editor. We have a managing editor, another faculty member who's in the school. And we're still doing traditional journalism, too. Right. So this is sort of something I'm doing over here. I think all the journalisms that we've talked about today are still all important. We need to do all of it. And so I'll just make a pitch as we're heading out here to support your local journalists, right? And
don't you have a T-shirt that says something about trusting journalists?
I used to have a T-shirt that said, trust me, I'm a reporter. And we wore them sarcastically. But now, of course, it's very sad. I wouldn't wear that anymore.
Well, thank you for opening our eyes to the kind of new directions that journalists may be taking in the future. My guest has been Sue Robinson, and we've been talking about Should Journalists Be Trusted? I'm Emily Auerbach, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.